Good morning. Thank you. My name is David Bradley. I'm with The Atlantic. I'm in my usual, more de minimis role of introducing people, but it just continues to be a pleasure for me. We have two remarkable guests and a lovely, deeply smart moderator to engage the conversation today. So I want to introduce our two guests, if I may. Norman Lear. During the mid-1980s, there was a young Swarthmore grad named Fromy Cohen. Fromy wanted to work in journalism, and so she did Stations of the Cross in New York, trying to work for the New York Times in New York. I'm sorry. Can you ramp? Where's our sound? Can you ramp me up a little bit? Okay. Is it changed already, or is it the same?
I think it's better.
Is it better?
Better.
Good morning. My name is David Bradley. So in the mid-1980s, there was a young Swarthmore grad named Fromy Cohen who wanted to work in journalism. And she tried everywhere in New York and finally ended up moving to Washington, went to the Post, went to the alternative papers, went to the trade associations, the newsletters, nothing. And she was visiting her grandmother in Philadelphia. And she said, Granny, I'm giving up on journalism. And her grandmother said, well, why don't you write that nice Mr. Sulzberger letter and see if he'd arrange it? Arthur Sulzberger was the publisher of the New York Times. He said, Granny, why in the world would he pay any attention to that? And she said, oh, well, during the war 40 years ago, your grandfather was a good friend of Mr. Sulzberger's and actually participated in saving his life. So Fromy wrote a letter, drafted a letter. I don't know it exactly, but the temperament of it was something like this. Dear Mr. Sulzberger, my name's Fromy Cohen. I can't believe I'm writing this letter. I'm sure I'm not going to send this letter. This is so embarrassing. Actually, it was 40 years ago, and you can't possibly remember. My grandmother says you knew my grandfather, so-and-so, during the war. Now that I've written this, I know I'm not going to write it, but just in case I do, or send it, but just in case I do, I'm really trying to get a job in journalism. Sincerely yours, Fromy Cohen. 2 weeks passed, and she got a letter back on the stationery of the publisher of the New York Times. Dear Miss Cohen, 40 years is but a twinkle of an eye when you love a man as much as I loved your grandfather. You will be hearing from a member of my staff. Welcome to the New York Times. It's a remarkable story. Don't we all have that story of somebody we knew in our childhood who went on and succeeded in some famous and fantastic way, and we led a more quiet life, but we always watched them and we're proud of their success, but we had that question in the back of the mind, do they remember? Do they remember us like we now see them with such fondness? For my mother, who is 85 years old, that person is Norman Lear. That person is Norman Lear. In the evocative years right before the Second World War, they were together at Emerson College. And they were, at least in my mother's telling across my childhood, they were in a small group that they called the Seacoles, which was, it's named after a Shakespearean character, so modest that he never came on stage. Norman Lear went on to both brave and brilliant things. As the brave, he left Emerson College, joined the U.S. Air Force, did B-17 Flying Fortress missions over Europe, for which he was decorated. And then together, everyone in this room knows his brilliance. His breakthrough was writing and directing Divorce American Style. And then he began the greatest run of television hits in the 80-year history of the medium. All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, Different Strokes, The Jeffersons, Mary Hartman, Who's the Boss, Married with Children. Television Academy, Hall of Fame, 4 Emmy Awards, Peabody Award, his own star on the Hollywood Walk. And all the while, my mom and my family watched, loving his success, but always tugged by that question. So yesterday, after the afternoon session, I sought out Mr. Lear, and I introduced myself. And as we chatted for a few moments, and he left the tent, and the moment he was gone, I pulled out my cell phone, and I called my mother in Nantucket, and I said, he remembers. Ben Bradley, executive editor of the Washington Post for 23 years, now senior vice president there, even in partial retirement. Some time ago, The Atlantic ran a cover story on the Saudi royal family. It was fine, but we didn't get access inside the royal family, so it's kind of a B-minus execution. I was having lunch with Bob Woodward and arrived a few minutes before he did, and then he slid into the booth, and as he was sitting down, he instantly said, I love the story on the Saudi royal family. And there was this pause, and he said, well, actually, I didn't like it. And then he said, if I had turned that article in to Ben Bradley, another day would have gone by, he would have read it, and then he would have come out into the newsroom yelling, Woodward, you bastard, God damn it, where are the men in the moment of action? And he said, his great gift was driving you not just the factual basis, but defining the particular moment of drama that brings the whole thing forward. So, in Woodward's telling, if he had wanted me to write about Bush going to war, he wouldn't have wanted just the general history. He'd want that Thursday evening at 8:30 in the Oval Office when Condi Rice and the president are all by himself, and the president pauses for a moment and he says, God damn it, Condi, we're going in. For a generation, his generation, Ben Bradley employed the best political reporters in the world. And for that period of time, they did their best work under Ben Bradley. Sally Quinn, his wife, who is equally famous in our city, wrote a small profile of Vernon Jordan in the middle of one of the regular controversies in Washington. And she said, though you would remember and repeat it with so much more tartness than I can do it, but forgive me giving a bland repetition of it. She said that the thing that separates Jordan from everybody else in the controversy is Jordan is from Washington. He's a resident there. We all know him personally. We know his character. He is of Washington, and we love him. She could have written those exact same words for all of us in Washington as to Ben Bradley. For those of us in Washington, he is one of us, and we deeply love this man. And then we have the nicest person to introduce him. Margaret Carlson, under the protocols here, I'm not supposed to introduce the moderator who will then lead the discussions. But I must tell you that of all the people I wished I could hire and have not been able to, who's been on a trajectory of such vertical velocity that she leaves all the rest of us in a lonely arc, it's Margaret Carlson. She is Walter Isaacson's discovery from Time Magazine years. She was the first columnist at Time Magazine, CNN analyst. She's now the editor-at-large for The Week, which is this hot weekly magazine causing all sorts of intellectual damage inside the other news weeklies. And she will moderate. We have the nicest turn of events. Sally has been asked to do a brief introduction herself of at least one she loves, or maybe two she loves, and then Margaret will lead the discussion.
I first met Norman Lear when I went out to California to do a book tour, and my friend Sandy Van Oker said, there's this great guy, and you've really got to meet him. So I called Norman, and he and his then-wife, Frances, invited me over for dinner. And I fell madly in love with Norman. I thought he was the sexiest, smartest, most brilliant, talented person I'd ever met. And I was with Ben at the time. And when I got home, I said to Ben, you know, I've just met the greatest guy, and he and I just bonded. I mean, we just became best friends. I just knew that Norman was going to be my best friend. So a couple weeks later, Norman called and said he was coming to Washington, and I said, we're going to have a dinner, and I can't wait to see him. Norman walked in the room, took one look at Ben, and I was chopped liver. They fell in love with each other like I have never seen anywhere except on the movie screen. And they have been in love ever since. And I just sort of, I hang around the periphery. Norman, Ben hates to talk on the telephone. I mean, I've been away for 3 weeks. I'll call Ben, and the first thing he says is, okay, you know, the phone call is over. We're in the middle of dinner, and Norman calls. It's Norman! And he sits there for an hour talking to Norman on the phone. It's really annoying, I have to say. Ben wrote a book, which some of you may have read, called A Good Life. He was writing the book at the same time that Katharine Graham was writing her book. And in fact, one day, David Halberstam called him, and Ben was saying, I don't know what to call it. And David said, well, you know, call it A Good Life. You've had a good life. So he decided to do that. And he told Kay, and his book was coming out before Kay's, and they were very competitive about their books. And Kay came back to him a couple days later, and she said, well, I've thought of a title for my book. And Ben said, what is it? And she said, A Better Life. Now, Ben will be 85 in August. Norman will be 84 this month. They not only have had good lives, they've had better lives. They've had the best lives. And this panel was supposed to be about news and entertainment, and I'm sure they're going to get there. But I think that you all saw the movie When Harry Met Sally, and there was the orgasm scene, and the woman next to the table said, "I'll have what she's having." Well, that's what, when people look at Ben and Norman, they think, "I'll have what they're having." Margaret is now going to get them to tell you how they've had these fabulous lives.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've never felt like such a third wheeler, maybe one, the fifth wheel here, but and that was very touching, David and Sally, very sweet. And instead of asking questions about what Ben would have done with the wiretap story or what Norman thinks of what's on television today or the FCC, let me kind of get back to what Sally posed. Here I am actually with two of my heroes.
What Ben, a ego trip. This is
Ben. Ben made me get into journalism. I was in law school during Watergate, but I could think of it. I could be a lawyer with a house in Aspen. Instead, I'm just an ink-stained wretch because of Ben Bradley and Watergate. And Norm made me watch too much TV, maybe almost the first TV I really watched with All in the Family. But what I want to know is, how did you two not just get so successful, but get so happy? And the answer is not Lynn and Sally, because those are the answers. But aside from
I was going
from
to say
that.
The first moment I had, I wanted to introduce my now wife, which is, you know, a major reason I think we're sitting with the major. We're bracketed by the major reasons for what you're
Well, we can't
question.
Marry either one of them, and we would like to know, aside from such good fortune, what is it? Because not everyone who's successful is happy.
Well, I don't know. Certainly one of the things is not to know so goddamn much about everything that you worry about everything. I don't really worry very much. I mean, I have...
But that's because Sally worries about everything.
Well, that's fine, but that doesn't take care of me. Well, yeah, I mean, most men, you know, worry about their job, their children, their... And I should worry about some of those things, but I worry about very little. I don't. I'm really interested in making it till tomorrow, and I'm really interested in having a good time, meeting new people. I found an extraordinary woman, and what the hell? That's about it.
Well, I always say to Sally, I want to come back as Ben Bradley because it is quite.
You've got to wait a little, but then there's going to be plenty of time.
So when you were 30, did you not worry?
When I was 30, what was I doing when I was 30?
You were 40. You know,
1951.
Those middle career years.
I was in Paris. No, I sure as hell didn't worry in Paris.
You and Artie, no worries.
Had a lot of friends and traveled a lot, had a marvelous job. I always think of the best jobs in journalism are the jobs with the second paper or the second magazine, whereas the first paper first magazine, in my case was Time, would send 10 people to Rome to cover something, and I would cover it for the same thing for Newsweek, and where they had a garçon de bureau and they had taxis and chauffeurs and all that stuff. We were really competing over 1,500 words in the next issue, and that was better to do it alone than with all those other people.
So you were the scrappy guy.
And
you both changed the medium that you were working in to some extent for All in the Family. I don't remember that much that I watched. I do remember Father Knows Best. The sort of lowest class person was an insurance agent on TV, and nothing happened outside the house. It was all inside that world. And you opened up so that we knew there was an Archie Bunker, we knew Meathead, we knew about social issues, and you did four programs like that. How did you get TV from Father Knows Best to All in the Family?
I can tell you how I did All in the Family, but I don't know how I got from... I wasn't thinking about that. I had read that there was an English antecedent called
To Death Do Us Part.
Yeah. And I had read about that, and I said, it was
any help you can give our memories, we would really like it. It would
be very helpful. And that was my father. My father, we were Jewish. My father spoke of black people as Schwarzes. I would say, how can you call put down a race of people using, expletives like that? He would tell me I was the dumbest white kid he ever met. I said, there you're doing it again. Put down a whole race of people to call me dumb. He never got it. So I read about this. I knew this was my family. I knew that guy. I knew how much he loved his family. And I knew he would, kill for us, cut off his arm for us. He was a human being who was that bigot. And that, I just ached to do that. I had just done a film called Cold Turkey, and starring Dick Van Dyke and so forth. I loved the film. It was a great piece of satire, I thought. And I had been offered a three-picture deal at United Artists. And everybody in my world told me, you've got to do these, take that three-picture deal. They'll make this pilot. They'll never put it on the air. It's too, But it took 3 years. I could not put it away. And that's how that happened.
And you just kept at it.
Can I go back to something you asked when you were talking about how we got our attitudes about that? There's nothing better than being born into a family with low expectations. Nobody gave a damn nobody asked me if I wished to go to college. Nobody asked me what I wanted to be. I just grew with these low expectations to the point where, I love telling this story. Some years ago, I was inducted. I got a telephone call that they were, the National Television Academy of Arts and Sciences was going to start a Hall of Fame. And among the first inductees were William Sarnoff and Bill Paley and Edward R. Murrow, Lucille Ball, Patty Chayefsky, Milton Berle, and me. So I called my mom instantly, because that's all I always did, to tell her. And I said, Mom, this is happening. These are the so forth. And I'm going in with William Paley and Sarnoff and so forth and so forth. And she said, listen, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say? So everything is gravy from that.
Well, I had a teacher who said you should never look behind you. I mean, you should never look ahead of you, above you, and only look behind to see what could have happened if you didn't have incredible good fortune. And most people don't attribute where they are to good fortune. I was on a TV program with Bob Novak for years, and he thought his success was all due to his brains and nothing to do to good fortune. Did you have good fortune?
Oh, God. Yes. I mean, incredible fortune.
But you, unlike Norman Lear, you were kind of born into...
Oh, God, we got to go through that, do we?
A little bit of it. Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
There has to be a little tension, Mr. Perfect.
Well, the Depression got most of that out of my family. My dad lost his job, and we got to a point where we were like other people, and so I don't remember that much.
But the name.
Crow and
Shield.
The name you were born with, I love the name you were born with.
What?
Crowenshield.
Crowenshield.
You see, I'm I'm an Irish Catholic, so I don't even know how to pronounce
those
names.
Well, I'm not an Irish Catholic, and I'm not Jewish, so shut up, both of you. I've dreamt of being Jewish a lot. But
every panel needs a wasp, so you're our token
wasp. Well,
you got one. Yeah. So, good fortune.
Well, just amazing. I mean, the war, I had a great deal of luck, had an interesting war, didn't get deaded, came back. I got a good job with a marvelous starting newspaper in New Hampshire, had a wonderful editor, a wonderful guy who was having a nervous breakdown as editor of a paper in St. Louis, and he was a night clerk in a hotel in New Hampshire. And we got him out of that, and he tapered back into the business that way. Got a job at the Washington Post. The luckiest
of
me.
Who hired you?
A guy called. Well, I mean, in those days, the Post lost $1 million a year. The owner hired you at $80
a week.
Yeah, four grand a year. They had to go to the owner to say, "Can I spend that?" I set out looking for a job on a train from Boston, and I had two interviews, one in Baltimore and one in Washington. And when I got to Baltimore, it was raining so goddamn hard that I said, I'm not going to get out of this train there. And went on to Washington, and I went to the Washington appointment.
You skipped that interview.
I skipped it.
Yeah.
And I got a job at the Washington Post interview, so what the hell? And then, I got, you don't want to go all through that.
No, but we don't. But what was it like to go back on the ship or go back to the South Pacific and relive a little bit of your
I just came back from Guadalcanal, which is, nobody knows what it means. God, that has fascinated me. I've talked to people that I thought were really well educated, and they say, you went where? There's a little paper called Tin Can Sailor, which is for people who worked on destroyers, who served on destroyers. It comes out whenever they can get a couple of bucks together. And it had an ad in it saying there was a cruise going from New Guinea due east to Guadalcanal and then up all those little islands whose names nobody can remember. Bougainville, Rendova, Vella La Vella, Choiseul, all this stuff. And so I booked it for myself. And when I came back, I told Sally about it. And she said, that sounds like the dullest goddamn trip I've ever heard. And I no way she would go, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and our son wanted to go very much. So I said, okay. And then as the deadline approached, Sally said, well, I think I'll come too. And so she went. And so we went to Guadalcanal. Spent two and a half weeks there. By then, I owed money to the travel agent, so I had to get. I sold it to the New Yorker. Now all I got to do is write it.
Right, it's always the hardest part.
And I just want to add something on the question of good luck. I mean, good luck, good fortune. Just to be here at 85, soon to be 84. You know, what do you owe that to? And I think often on the subject of what is God, all of those things that we can't take credit for, and they are far more, there are far more things we can't take credit for than the things we can, that all add up to good fortune. David Bradley in the introduction mentioned my participation in World War II. I flew on a B-17. In the 15th Air Force, which was an air force of B-24s. The difference between the B-24 and the B-17 is best told in the statistics that I don't remember, but far more B-24s were lost than B-17s because the Flying Fortress was just a better plane. I was in the only wing of the 15th Air Force that made up of B-17s. What do I owe that to?
So when you're getting your All in the Family mod and whatever, did you have to fight? Did you have to push back hard against network, the suits, as they call them?
ABC bought the show and I made the pilot with Carol O'Connor, and I keep forgetting to turn to this side also, with Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton and two other young people. And they contractually, they had the right to ask me to make it again or drop it after a year. They asked me to make it again. I wasn't as satisfied as I thought I could be with the two younger actors, so I got two other actors and made it a second time. They didn't pick it up. And people within the network told me they were afraid of it. They, you know, I knew from what I'd heard about the screenings that everybody laughed, but for reasons you can imagine, they didn't pick it up. 3 years and some months later, I was finishing the editing of Cold Turkey, and a new executive came in to run CBS, and he called for that pilot that he'd heard about and looked at it, told me I was, you know, they were going to do 13, pick up 13. But 2 weeks after I'd made a couple of shows, wished me to air the second show I'd made first. And the first show I made, I thought we were showing 360 degrees of that character and this family, and we were going to jump into the water together. And, you know, you can't get wetter than wet, but and this was the script to do it. And it was the same script I'd made twice before. Not a word change. And it wasn't until the night before we were to air that I was able to call home and say, they're going to put the right show on, because I had threatened not to come back at all. And I meant it, because I had a three-picture deal at United Artists.
So. Right. So a friend of mine, Tom Fontana, who did Homicide: Life on the Street, and just did a half-hour show for WB Network, had the FCC censor his program before it went on the air. He had to take out various things. The show that actually was on streaming video on the internet got like 5 million hits as a result of this. But nonetheless, he was censored by the FCC. Did that ever happen to you?
Never heard from the FCC. Never heard from the government. No.
Yeah. So this is a Bush. Yes, this is a Bush era.
The euphemism for censor was program practices. Mm-hmm. That was a big department, and that's who we heard from.
Yeah. So was Meathead not Meathead in the original?
He went out
and got the.
Oh, you mean the actor?
The actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a great find.
Yeah. Well, Rob Reiner was always like a son. I knew him since he was 8 years old, and he auditioned the first year, but I thought he was too young, and. The third year, I mean, everything worked. It was a miracle, you know, that I've often thought, I can take credit for saying you, and you, but in no way can I take credit for all of the chemistry that developed among them in every direction. And that's, you know, the fates gave the show that.
Do you do political stuff with Rob now?
Yes, I'm helping him on a couple of initiatives, and yeah, we find ourselves in the same bed politically.
And how's People for the American Way? Which, by the way, for those of you who don't know, it's the liberal organization that is aware that there's religion in politics, their religious beliefs, and provides probably the best information there is when there's a judicial confirmation. I mean, the packets, the information is great, and it's now a Washington institution. You started it when? How's it doing?
We are celebrating our 25th
good
year.
God, is that true?
25 years. When I came to you guys and talked about doing this thing, what did you think?
People
25
told?
Years ago, yeah.
We thought it was a great idea.
I didn't get my arms around it. I mean, I can't imagine someone doing that, starting a new political organization.
Well, I didn't sit down to start a new organization. What I did was I wanted to. Oh God, this is so interesting to me. I watched Falwell and Robertson, the proliferation of TV evangelicals, and I thought it was amusing and dangerous. and probably in that order. They amused me, but I thought they were dangerous. And I had an idea to write a picture called Religion. I was a minister. I am a minister of the Universal Life Church. It was a $5 mail order ministry at the time I joined.
You can marry people.
I joined because on the aforementioned film Cold Turkey, I was going to take 3 credits. I wrote, produced, and directed. So I was going to take the directing credit as the Reverend Norman Lear, and I sent my $5. And then I learned that I was a reverend. God bless America in the eyes of the law. I'm as much a reverend as Billy Graham. So, and I've married 3 couples since over the years. Trey Parker of South Park fame, being the last. Anyway, I wanted to write a picture called Religion. To savage what I was seeing, the way Paddy Chayefsky savaged television with Network. And that's what I started to do, and I started to work on a screenplay. And then, in order to get it right, I watched hours upon hours, Jimmy Swaggart, Jimmy Baker, all of these guys proliferate. And I heard Swaggart one day intimate that he'd like people to pray for the death of a Supreme Court justice. And that was it. I had an idea for a television spot, a 60-second television PSA, and I did it. And it had a hard hat on a piece of, not unlike Archie, on a piece of heavy equipment, and the camera just pushed into him all the way. As he said, his wife and he and his kids disagreed on things politically all the time. It was the best discussion they had around the dinner table, but they never agreed. And here come a bunch of ministers on radio and television and in the mail telling them they are good Christians or bad Christians, depending on their political point of view. And he felt his wife was a better Christian than he was, but he agrees with the ministers on all of it, like Archie would. And he wound up saying there's got to be something wrong. Even if they're ministers, when people tell you they're good, you're a good Christian or a bad Christian, depending on your political point of view. I did that. It was a terrific piece. It still is. We run it occasionally, even now. But I looked at it and I said, "My God, you're Jewish. You made your money in Hollywood. 2 strikes against you. You got to get some help with this to get it on the air." And I went to South Bend, Indiana, and I saw Father Hesburgh, with whom I had an acquaintance, and he thought it was terrific, but I'll never forget his expression beyond that. He said, "In addition to everything you're concerned about, Norman, we," meaning mainline church leaders, "were concerned about the way they tortured Scripture." Can't forget a phrase like that, "the way they tortured Scripture." So he sent me to about 8 or 10 other mainline church leaders who signed on, and then I felt good about it, and we put it on the air in Washington. And there were only 3 networks. And just recently I found a piece of tape of Brokaw talking to me for 7.5 minutes after running the 60-second TV spot. Shows you what's happened to television over the years. And almost a half minute. And somebody said, "You got to organize around this." And somebody else said, his last line is, "That's not the American way. Call it People for the American Way." And an organization was born. I didn't wake up any one morning and say, "I'm going to start an organization." It just was an act of spontaneous combustion following that spot.
So, back to friendship for a minute. There's a recent study which says we're all going to live shorter lives because we're more alone than we've ever been, and that friendship is the answer and community, but the chances for that are ever smaller in the world we live in. So here you are, a journalist, and here he is, let me caricature, here's a Hollywood liberal, and you're a middle-of-the-road journalist, and you won't talk on the phone very long. He's out there. How did you
it's forge never available such a in my friendship? House.
hey, how about 2 lines? So how do you do that? How do you stay? How do you?
Well, I consider it a blessing that I've never been obsessed by some political direction. I'm not a professional anti-communist. I'm not a professional pro this or pro that. And somebody drummed into me that journalism, you don't have that luxury. And so what you're interested in is the people. And I mean, provided they're not espousing some cause that's really horrible, you like the person or you don't like the person. And I've never written an editorial in my life. God willing, I never will. I don't like to tell people what to think. I like to tell people what I think is the truth and let them make up their own mind. I mean, I don't mean that in you know, anti-Norman in the slightest. God, I love his energy.
Really? Yeah.
I love his energy and his enthusiasm for things is the most contagious and the most energizing thing.
Like Norm is out
there
being
passionate.
Yes. Yeah.
But
and you're a cooler customer, I'd say.
Can I ask you a question?
Foot.
You invited me once or twice to sit in when you were running the paper on sessions when you were deciding what the front page would be.
Yeah.
And in the course of those decisions, I never heard anybody talk about a point of view or anything, or you know. But the fact that you decided this goes on page 1 and that goes on page 24, is there no editorial? I mean, isn't there some judgment in that is beyond?
Yeah, probably. But it's more. What appeals to you in the last analysis? Certain things. You know, you can't fill up the front page with. I'm a jock at heart. You can't fill up the front page with sports. You can't fill up the front page with cheesecake. You can't. You know, there's certain things you can't do. And you listen to what each section proposes as the most important, significant event in their area, and then you see if you can squeeze it into a. I think people. I don't like animal stories.
No panda stories.
No, well, I like the pandas, but some cat in a tree will just drive me crazy. Leave the son of a. And I think that the next editor subconsciously does that. The other editors begin to push stories that they think he'll like, and that's fine.
Margaret, I've lost track of time because I don't have a watch.
Can I? I just want to, if you don't mind, for a second.
Oh, Sal, not anything I said about you.
No. But I just going back to this thing of happiness and how do you get it and all of that. I want to know from both of you about torment and about the darkest times and how you got through it. I had lunch with Leon Wieseltier last week, and he said to me, you know, I really like Ben and I really admire Ben a lot, but I just don't understand him. There is no torment there at all. And of course that is true. But I think Norman, sometimes you may have been more tormented, but I've been through Watergate with Ben, and we've been through a child almost dying, and you present yourself as very insouciant, and yet I wonder how you get through those rough times, and you, Norman, how you get through your rough times.
Well, you know, if I had to talk about rough times, I could certainly pick them out of my life. My father went to prison when I was 9 years old. So at 84, I still wrestle with that. You know, trying to find out, well, what did that do to me? I've spent most of my life thinking, why do I have to bother finding out what that did to me? I love life. I'm doing fine. I really have learned I think, to live in the moment. And that's not a wall-to-wall and floor-to-ceiling, but I, for the most part, live in the moment. At my 80th, big crowd, we raised a bunch of money for people for the American Way, but when I was having the last word, I heard myself say, I had not anticipated saying it, you know, I have to confess something. I am already thinking of coffee, the taste of coffee the next tomorrow morning, and the sight of my wife and my kids in the morning. And this is over. And then it occurred to me that misunderstood or not sufficiently considered important words are over and next.
Over and what?
Over and next.
Yeah.
You know, something is over and then next. And maybe the hammock in the middle is living in the moment. But, you know, I love this. I'm having a great time here. But I'm well aware that Lynn and I will be on a plane at 1 o'clock, and I wonder what salad dressing she's going to have.
Well, Reverend Lear. So, Ben, can you answer Sally's question?
Well, I
torment, I, sadness, torment.
What's
questions?
Wrong with not having any torment? I don't have torment. I mean, things piss me off, excuse the expression. And but for about 5 minutes, and then you've got to get on with it. And luckily, I've got enough interests that there's a competition. There's still competition for my time. Mm-hmm. And I think if I didn't have extracurricular activities, things to do, I'd die. I mean, I'd die. We have this place.
You've gone gracefully into like another stage.
Yeah, I've been at all 15 years ago, I did that.
Your birthdays, which you always have something to say about, you know, life as it is right now. But you, I mean, you went from being in totally in the thick of things to, you know, another kind of life. How was that? How did you make that transition? Gradually?
Well, somebody made it for me. I mean, I got to be 70, and they'd already extended the retirement age 5 years. And they weren't going to do it again. And believe it or not, it was plain that they shouldn't, because I was beginning to be bored by some things. I mean, I didn't. I said this last night at some. The idea of following, to make a separate story out of a bill being introduced, having hearings, passing through a committee, then going through the House, and then that's four stories, then going to the Senate and doing the same damn thing, and then going to committee is, you know, up to nine now, and then the Congress votes on it, that's 10, and is signed by the president. You got to have 10 stories on something that probably isn't worth that much energy. So I'd love to get, I'm awful glad to be rid of that.
Right.
But on the other hand, if there's a good story, I die.
Lorena Bobbitt.
Do you remember her? You all remember her, don't you? I've seen the picture.
Oh. But what was not published?
I'm not going to tell you.
Was not published.
No, it was not published. I don't think it was even close.
Would you?
That was the closest I've ever seen you to torment, because you had been out of the editor's job for 6 months and you went absolutely insane.
What would you have done with the picture?
I would have passed it around to my friends. What the?
So before we do questions and answers, you know, Watergate for 30 years is, yeah. I mean, it's the benchmark of everything. So we have the New York Times being pilloried by the Bush administration for publishing the story about tracking the financial information of terrorists, somehow exempting the Wall Street Journal from the general condemnation.
And the Post.
And the Post.
Wonder why.
You know, I mean, I think the New York Post headline was New York Crimes. Or was it, so how do you read the coming down so hard on the New York Times? But what would you have done? Is there any, you know, the Treasury Department had mostly bragged about what they were doing to journalists with this financial information, but suddenly it's a huge secret. You're not supposed to publish it. They asked them not to. So just put yourself back at age 70, and what would you have done?
I really am reluctant to tell you, but without knowing all of the facts, I certainly would go into this period of decision saying, and we always did that. If we had any reason not to publish something, we always delayed it 24 hours after making a decision that we were going to publish it. And then get the story ready, answer all the goddamn questions we could, and then re-examine it. And we'd appoint a committee telling us that we had to not publish it, couldn't publish it. And then we had to argue with that committee to see whether we should. And then we did or didn't. Mm-hmm. But I think the Times, I hate to say that I think that the president was right in the Times queries, because I would have certainly made the first decision to publish it and then listen to it. I don't know what they were doing for 12 months. I just can't imagine nursing a story that long. I'd have, I think you could have come to some resolution, get some part of it into the pit. That's the great thing to do. Get some part of it if you can't get all of it. Get some part into it. And then people like you will come nattering around this way and get the, you know, get another hunk, get another hunk, get another hunk, and pretty soon it's out.
Yeah. What do you think of reporters today?
Oh, I think the quality of reporting and the quality of writing, especially by women, you'll be glad to hear.
Thank you.
It's just extraordinary. Much, much better than what it was when 25, 30 years ago when I was there. You've got 25% of the papers that you had. You know, you had 7,000 dailies. Don't hold me to my statistic, but it's down to 1,500 or something like that now. And you can't tell me the quality of journalism is less. The remaining, the good papers are better. You know, what's changed is the delivery system. The internet, we're just delivering it in a different way. You know, nobody's going through the back alley of Boston yelling extra, which was my first connection with the distribution of journalism.
But you know, as David Bradley said about Bob Woodward, there's no one like you around the Post getting that, I don't mean to single out the Post, but getting that drama, that man of action into stories, you know, the way you did it. There's that, what did you call it, the oh shit story?
I don't talk
about it.
Oh, what is it, Sally?
Holy shit, sorry.
So let me open it to questions. Lynn, do you have a question?
No, please.
Answer the one on
Torment about
Norma. Oh, please.
How?
Do you relieve it or cause it?
That's a good question. I just want to say with Norman, he really does live in the moment, and there is a joy that he lives every day, and it comes through in his relationships with his friends, his family, and it's pretty remarkable.
You think I live in the moment?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and most of the time I like it.
Sometimes it drives you a little crazy.
It drives
right?
you a little crazy. Yeah. Ben went. There was an annual meeting of all the reporters and editors of the Post, and this one guy got up and he told the story, and he said that there was a farmer, and one year that they had this terrible drought, and all of his crops were ruined, and the next year was a flood, and everything was ruined. The next year was pestilence and everything was ruined. And finally he said, God, you know, why are you doing this to me? And God looked down at him and said, I don't know. There's just something about you that pisses me off. And this guy Harwood said to Ben, you know, Bradley, there's something about you that pisses me off. And that's what it is. It drives people crazy.
The best there's reporter on the paper.
there's an insouciance about Ben. If you look at Ben's book and Kay Graham's book, both of which were written, most of it except for their childhood, about the same stories, the same issues, Watergate and Pentagon Papers and the strike and everything, and Ben sort of, and then I went to war, and then I went to the, you know, we had the strike, and then we had Watergate, and Kay's was, and then I lay awake all night, and I didn't sleep, and oh my God, and it used to drive her crazy too. The only thing that makes me nuts is when I'm really worried about something and Ben says, when the history of the world is written, this is not going to be in it.
What's the matter with that?
Yeah.
My way of doing that to Lynn is saying there are a couple of billion people in China who don't know this is going on and they're all getting through.
Okay, yes, please.
Still you now? How do you explore your creative sides now? Sort of after you've accomplished so much.
Has a bunch of organizations.
I'm still working, so
yeah.
We have a major minor music company. We're the preeminent jazz label and blues label and so forth, and I'm enjoying that. It's a brand new life for me. I'm making that film Religion now from 25 years ago. So I'm engaged. I can't consider retirement. And I wouldn't call everything I know about what Ben's involved in any kind of retirement.
No. I've got one gig I have advising a publisher, a man called Tony O'Reilly, whom some of you may know. He ran Heinz Company for years. He's an Irishman, and he owns papers in Ireland, South Africa, India, New Zealand, Australia, blah, blah, blah. And so that takes, that takes me some time, not a whole lot.
But then you work every day. You go to work at 9:30 and come home at 6:30.
Yeah, I do. I work every day.
What do you do? What do you do there?
Well, I mean, I
you
run.
Go in, you
I
turn
have,
on the light. You have your coffee. What do you do?
Well, let me tell you.
Please.
I have a little part of my life that revolves around a house that Sally and I have on the St. Mary's River down in St. Mary's County, about 70 miles south of Washington. And I ran a museum there, believe it or not, the historic St. Mary's City, fourth oldest settlement in America, for, when I knew about running a museum, give me a break, it was terrible. I ran it for 12 years, and now I'm vice something. And we're trying to rebuild the place where Margaret Brent tried to get the first vote.
Well, it's like Jamestown.
It's not like Jamestown is, because Jamestown's all rebuilt. This has got old ruins on it. I do that. I do, what the hell else can I do? I know. I'm writing now a piece on Guadalcanal. I went out there and I'm going to do a piece for the New Yorker as soon as I get
Last week you did three speeches, and one day I called you about five times, and you were doing a different interview every single time.
Yeah. I seem to have sort of little waves of where I get my nose back into the public domain, and people show me some attention. And then I go back and, into the refuse and come back up again. My friends like Woodward and people like that, they get into trouble every so often and they involve me. I go down to the, somebody called me a stop on the tour of the Washington Post, which is a really good description because sometimes they bring around young reporters and I talk to them and help them if I can. If asked.
You've been involved with Art Buchwald a lot.
Oh, I'm very involved with my friend Art Buchwald. I don't know how many of you know him, who's in the process of checking out. And I've only known him longer than I've known Norman, 50 years.
He's making three acts of checking out.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah. He's home now. I talked to him the other day. He's in back up in Martha's Vineyard. He said, I just spent $12,000 putting a railway up his stairs. And he's holding court. And he's been holding court at this dreadful hospice in Washington.
We visited together there.
Yeah, I took him.
Did they kick him out of the hospice?
No, no, they didn't. They should have. There's a 30-day limit or a 60-day limit, and now they're permanent guest there. He's got.
Go ahead.
The majority of young people today, I want to say young is like 40 and under, don't read newspaper.
Yep.
They get most of their news from television or the internet. So given that population and that population is getting older, what do you think is the future of the newspaper?
Well, let me say first that where do you think the internet gets its news? It really gets it from the newspaper. Television, the nightly television news broadcasts, I can tell you what stories they're going to do next. The amount of times they have a news story that wasn't in the Post or the Times is very, very rare. And I think the newspaper... The newspaper company I work for is very successful financially. The Post itself, the newspaper, makes slightly less because, it makes maybe 80 million bucks a year instead of 100. It's hardly a failing business. But it's, I think, I just think it is the fountainhead of the information that keeps the wheels moving. Now maybe your person 40 years old. I think they read it. I think the age of readers is older, and kids don't come into the readership and early at all, but. I mean, it's just amazing. We started as children. I think I learned how to read reading about the Boston Red Sox. I know I learned how arithmetic out of figuring averages, so that doesn't happen that way. But the world is still in balance because they are learning. They're a little bit late. I'm going to stay the course. I think the future is just fine. Most of the good companies have gotten other business to invest in. First it was television. Now television isn't that great a business. The Washington Post has a business of a company that owns, the name I've now forgotten.
Kaplan,
that owns colleges. We own three law schools, for God's sakes.
So I could have stayed in law school and kind of followed.
We'd have met then.
Right.
That way.
David, I'm going to let, I don't have a watch, I'm going to let you tell me when we should deconvene.
I'm thinking there's nothing until lunch.
Right.
So we don't have to stay that long, but I don't see any burden to end a conversation.
Michael?
May I ask you both at the beginning of these good lives, extraordinary lives, despite differences of fortune and birth, did you end up doing what you wanted to do in the first place? Was this by accident or was it on purpose? And if you were following your ambitions, what prompted them?
Well, there came a time when I was really became interested in newspapers, but the first time was when my old man said, "You got to work this summer." And I said, "What the hell will I do?" And he said he had a friend in Beverly, Massachusetts, who said, "I'll give him a job as a copy boy, 10 bucks a week." And I had this unbelievable time. I just loved it. After being, filling all the inkwells? I haven't said inkwells for years. Filling all the inkwells and getting copy paper and doing that stuff. they sent me out on the street to write a column called City Locals. And what I did was go down and each on Main Street, go into the hardware store and talk to the owner and come back with, you know, he put his boat in the water last week and his mother-in-law is staying and that kind of stuff. And it didn't come up again in my life after that year I was 16 because of the war. I mean, my generation was headed for the war, so we didn't, our summer occupation was, in my case, going to getting through college fast, and I was in the commission in ROTC, so the minute I graduated, I was on my way out to the Pacific. So, and then I couldn't find a job after the war. You forget that the people, they held jobs open for returning veterans. I was a returning veteran, but I didn't have any history beforehand. I had no job. So I joined a group starting a paper, and it was what I had done, and I loved every minute of it. My God, that little paper in New Hampshire, if we didn't work 20 hours a day, we would thought we were goofing off.
As for my answer to the question, as I said earlier, nobody ever asked me what I wanted to do. Nobody pointed me in any direction. I had the only role model that I cared about. I had an Uncle Jack who flicked me a quarter every time he saw me. And so I wanted to be an uncle who flicked a quarter. And he was a press agent. I didn't know what a press agent was. I learned later what a press agent was. So from Foggia, Italy, as the war was ending, I stood over a typographer. I had gone to Emerson College for a year and then...
In Boston?
In Boston.
I didn't know that.
And then that's where I met Marianne Sullivan and enlisted from there after about a year and a quarter. And so I wanted to be an uncle who could flick a quarter to a nephew. He was a press agent. I stood over in Foggia, Italy, knowing that the war had come to an end, and helped a guy behind a linotype pick a letter for letter, and sent a page to my Uncle Jack, who copied it and sent to 12 public relations firms in New York and Los Angeles. And this letter just raved about the kind of press agent I would be coming out of this service. And I did get a firm job offer and an offer for an interview. That's all out of the 12. And I took a job off the interview and became a press agent. And as a press agent, we used to write these smart-ass witticisms for clients. So we had a client of a show called Are You With It? It was a review. And one of the acts in this review was Buster Shaver and his midgets. And the lead midget was Olive. So Dorothy Kilgallen, for those of you who may remember that name, printed an item written by this kid, Norman Lear, that Buster Shaver and Olive had been seen shopping Fifth Avenue, he on foot, she on a St. Bernard. And somebody must have said something to Kilgallen, and she bawled the shit out of George Ross, for whom I was working, and wanted to fire me, and I had to go to her and beg her to forgive me. And I was making 40 bucks a week. And George took me down to 35. By way of punishing me, and we were expecting a baby, so I went back to Hartford, and from there to Los Angeles again to become a press agent. But I ran into a guy who wanted to write comedy, and I had already been writing a kind of comedy, so so that's how it started.
So how old were you when you were flicking? You were the uncle who could flick the quarters.
By the time I could flick a quarter.
Happily, easily, without thinking about it.
27, 28.
And you were out in L.A.
I was doing the Martin and Lewis show. No, I couldn't flick a quarter then.
But I think what Michael was asking was, have you all achieved what you hoped to achieve? Are you there?
Way farther. Way farther.
Is that right?
Never.
I mean, times 1,000.
And for me, absolutely the truth.
Mark? Yes.
As a member of the baby boomer generation, I don't ever remember being so depressed about the state of the world and Katrina and America. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? And in comparison with past things, how does this rate?
Oh, well, I'm essentially an optimistic person. I mean, I can't point to you some situations that I think are absolutely wonderful and everything is going just perfectly, but I don't spend much time worrying about, I don't spend as much time as I should worrying about Darfur. I can't get my arms around that. I can't change that. But, I can do things that will, have more impact, perhaps. But.
Norm?
Well, optimism and pessimism for me, I seem like short term. I think in the short term, am I optimistic? I think things are really difficult. I don't see the way out for a little while. So short term, I'm not optimistic. But long term, I think hopeful is a better word.
You look forward to life.
Oh, yes. And I won't wake up the morning I'm not looking forward to it. And we will get through. Herman Kahn used to say, we shall muddle through. Yeah. And we will muddle through. But when you ask me, am I optimistic about it, it feels like a short-term word to me. And the short term, I think it's in Yiddish, Aftzaluchas.
One more.
I just like to say,
this is Jay Samrich, one of the great directors of television of all time. That's Michael York, the great actor. And this is Susan Silver, with whom I worked many years ago in television, a great writer.
And there's Jerry
Rasher.
One of the words I haven't heard, and it's courage, courage of convictions. And I know both of you gentlemen, and it wasn't money,
it isn't status, but you both had to buck whoever was above you, whoever the establishment was, especially on All in the Family. I know when you said, Norman, I'm going to quit, it happened more than one time. And it wasn't because you had a three-picture deal. Yeah. It was because you really felt artistically you were challenged. And I think courage has a lot to do with optimism and the success that both of these gentlemen have, and yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Courage, as Dan Rather would say.
But if you're aware of your good fortune, courage and good fortune, it's easy to be courageous, or what passes for courage when you got things going for you.
You were taking
the chance of getting the whole show destroyed. And Ben, I'm sure, took a chance getting the whole newspaper destroyed. And it isn't just, well, I'm going to stand up for something. You really both stood up for something that was very important.
You know, that doesn't ring a bell with me.
Oh.
I mean, I can't, if you pin me to the wall and said, what was the courage involved in Watergate? I couldn't tell you what it was. I mean, I didn't feel like I was up against a dragon. I didn't feel that I think the owner of the paper had courage. When I think of courage, I think of going into a fight with somebody, and I don't want to fight, and I make myself fight.
It's courage and convictions, I think.
Well, yeah, okay.
You really felt it was important.
David, do you want to bring us home here?
On behalf of the Ideas Festival, I now conclude. Okay, now I'm talking for David Bradley. Could I ask a one-minute favor of you all? My mother turns 85 in August, and I'm watching this whole thing being filmed, and I'm thinking that I could give her the nicest gift if you all would sing Happy Birthday with me.
Oh, yeah.
And then, what's her name?
Her name is Marianne. And then at the end, if we could go quiet, and if you would just say happy birthday to my mother. And could I get Michael York, whom she'll know, and Justice Breyer? Could you come stand behind? Congressman Harmon, would you come by? Congressman Harmon? And if anybody else is famous or likes my mother, please come on up. Can anyone sing? I can't sing.
Okay, you start.
Who can sing? Michael, can you sing? Okay.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Marianne. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, Marianne.
Happy birthday, Marianne.
That's wonderful.